There we go. Now I'm recording audio, and of course, we were streaming in live video, so you should be aware of that. And hi, Mark. Welcome again. Oh, you're on mute. I think you're on mute.
Morning, Mark. Yeah, you are muted.
Oh, I'm muted.
Yeah.
Good morning.
Okay, let's crank up the volume a wee bit so that my recording can pick it up. Just in case you're wondering, I do use the audio recording like this. And the reason why I don't just simply record the Zoom presentations, although I suppose I could, I haven't been, because I'm live streaming to YouTube, and so there's no need. The YouTube will capture the video. But I record on audio, first of all, to have a backup, just in case. But secondly, because the live, oops, other way, the Google recording also produces a transcript as I go along. And what that allows me to do is almost immediately after our session, I can post the audio instead of having to wait for Google to produce the video so I can download the audio. So I can post the audio right away, and I can post a transcript right away. And so that lets me get the full spread of the content out as rapidly as possible. And I'm working on the assumption that there are other people out there who are following what we're doing, although not taking part in our video conferences. And that's,
I see like 20 views on some of the things, so
yeah,
unless you got your whole family team to get boosted.
I don't have any of my family following this.
No, I see some evidence that, you know, there must be somebody else watching some of this stuff.
Yeah, I think some people are indeed watching, which is good. Although, you know, for every live session, I always have a presentation in the can just in case nobody shows up for the conversation so that I have something to record. You know, the result is, and just with the focus on video recording for this course, which is a bit unusual for me, well, it's a lot unusual for me, the result is I'm producing a ton of video, probably too much for most people to wade through, as Jim, you're just stuck partway through values. Again, my longer-term plan isn't to have a course that is just a whole bunch of videos. You've seen already some of the graphing stuff that I'm trying to do with this. And as well, I'm trying to take the process of recording the videos as a way of reproducing all of my text for this course with an eye to taking that text, taking the transcriptions, cleaning them up, and then assembling them into a longer work after the course. Oh, and there's Sharita. And so we've got a season high 4 people. So this is awesome. So that's the other thing, too, in the back of my mind. I'm thinking, well, maybe this will be one of these courses that gets more and more popular as it goes on. That would be pretty funny. So, hi, Sharita. Welcome.
Hi.
So we've got Jim, Mark, Sharita, and, of course, myself. That's for the benefit of the people listening on audio. It's interesting with all these different recording formats. I always have to make sure that the different formats are supported. So, go ahead.
Can I ask what you showed us your recorder on your phone there? What app is that? That it does the transcript? I'm only aware of how AI doing a transcript.
It's called Recorder, and it's an app that's produced by Google. And it's the reason I bought a Google Pixel 4 rather than a Samsung or an iPhone or anything else, because I knew that Google was including this app on the phone natively, and I knew that it would probably be pretty good. And it has turned out pretty good. You know, the transcripts.
And what I like is when you save the recording, it offers the transcript, and then it offers to transfer it wherever you want, like to your laptop, or to your desktop, or to a Google Doc in your Drive with one click.
So it's very easy for me to make use of these recordings. The same with the audio as well. It saves the audio, and I can open it up right away in Audacity and then save it in Audacity as an MP3 with all of the metadata. I put the metadata in for posterity. Just for the record, we're up to 29 separate recordings. That's a rough count. That might, it's plus or minus 3 or 4. But my numbering is up to 29. So again, and it's funny because this process has been so easy that I've been forgetting that I'm recording. And I've had more than a few occasions where I've created 3 or 4 hour videos. I finish my presentation or whatever, and then the video is me eating or me watching Colbert on YouTube. It's horrible. So I'm trimming those, of course.
Trim them down.
Yeah. Or in one case, yesterday I deleted a 4 hour video because I had accidentally started it up again after finishing a presentation. It was my lunch, and then I was gone for a while, and I came back, and it was still, so it was recording a couple hours of an empty room. So
this is all streaming out on YouTube?
All streaming out on YouTube, live.
we just have to tweet out that link, and everybody can surveil Steven.
Well, that video is,
surveils himself.
Yeah, it's gone now. I deleted it, although, you know, I'm sort of, well, actually it's not gone because it was also recording. I use something called OBS, Open Broadcasting Systems, when I'm doing my presentations. In fact, I'm using it right now even. So here you all are. So that's what I'm seeing. And I can put myself into what I'm seeing. I can put myself as a picture-in-picture. I can do TV style in the news today. Full PowerPoint, and you see, like I said, I have a PowerPoint presentation in the can just in case nobody shows up. Here's the normal view that I use when I'm presenting PowerPoint. And I even have one for the terminal, although I don't have a terminal open at the moment. Anyhow, so I use OBS, and when I'm doing the presentations, I turn on not just the streaming, but the recording, because that's what I use. When I'm not in Zoom, I use OBS to stream to YouTube. So I actually have a recording of that four-hour session on my computer. And a few of these others. Sorry?
Could be an Andy Warhol tribute.
I was thinking, you know, like releasing a video, Stephen eats lunch.
Stephen's empty chair.
Stephen's empty chair, yeah. Stephen watches Colbert.
Stephen watches Warhol's sleep. Which would put you to sleep.
Yeah.
And we could watch you sleep while you're watching sleep. That. We should probably do something concerning the course.
Yeah.
I think you guys put me to sleep last night. I have to confess, I do most of this after I go to bed. It's on my phone. And only this morning was the first time I actually had a keyboard to alt-click and drag connections, so I would submit the nursing one just before the
oh, cool.
Live session this morning. But I frequently end up having to rewatch part of it, and then I was listening to an audio, and it must have gone on to play something else. And I woke up at just a little after midnight, hearing you and Mark talking about, saying, "Oh, I heard this conversation before." So that's my process for trying to catch up to this with all the other things that I'm doing during the day. I want to thank my Center for Teaching and Learning team who shifted our staff meeting so I could attend this morning live.
Oh, well, that's nice.
I'll let you go ahead.
So how have you been finding that graphing task?
Not fun.
Not fun, eh?
No. And not because I don't like the idea. For some reason, maybe physically, haven't learned how to connect properly. Because I keep on trying to do it, and it doesn't quite work.
What's happening instead?
Well, the thing that happens the most is I can't get a line.
Okay, yeah, and that's probably, you actually have to, and it took me a long time to figure this out as well. You actually have to click on the round node, or, you know, in some way highlight it, then press Alt, then drag your line. So it's rather more, you know, it would be more intuitive, and if I can figure out how to write the code so that it'll do this, I'll do this. I'm borrowing, of course, Matthias Melcher's code, because it's all a pretty complex piece of work to do, as I'm sure you can imagine. But if I can fix the code so that it detects when you're hovering over a dot, so that if you just click your mouse and drag, that should create a line. Right now, if you do that, it moves the dot.
It moves the, yes.
Which is so annoying, right?
Yes.
So what I want it to be is, instead of moving, I want it to draw a line. So I should be able to just flip-flop some instructions in there somewhere, but I have to find the instructions first. But it's on the list of things to make better, because I think it would be I think it's a useful exercise.
I do, too. I have no problem with the exercise. Mm-hmm. I have a problem with the execution.
Yeah.
Right?
I found it really interesting to try and figure out, you know, looking at that nursing code and say nothing about facial recognition, they say nothing about surveillance. Mm-hmm. They don't really even explicitly mention some of the other ones, but they're kind of implied or that.
Yeah.
There's and that's an interesting thing to observe, because it shows that some of the associations we draw here are very much a matter of interpretation. You know, it's us reading the code and seeing that content in the code, and different people might interpret it differently. I think they probably would. That's why I wish I had like 1,000 people doing these graphs. And, you know, my intent is to keep this up over time and see if people do indeed create these graphs, and, you know, or even try to just push out into social media, like a little micro exercise, just into Twitter, you know, like click here, do the graph, something like that. I think that might be interesting.
Except most people do Twitter on their mobile devices, and I don't know if you can do the graph on a mobile device.
I don't know either, actually. Yeah.
I didn't find any way to do it. I looked at it a couple of times, and okay, I'll have to wait until I'm actually sitting here to do that.
It should work.
As you say that, you know, I'm thinking about, you made this course without registration. I can take people from our college or from our Center for Teaching and Learning and look at a particular aspect when we're considering something about ethics. So I have something, and we can go there together.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's one of the advantages of not requiring registration is, you know, anyone can jump into any part of the course, including the tasks, and try anything. I'm just trying to see if it does work here.
That's not too much for your ego, though, Stephen, if you don't know how many people, if you can't prove how many people are using it.
That's I actually mentioned that when I did a presentation on setting this up without registration a couple of weeks ago, and it's one of the things I mentioned that, you know, yeah, it's kind of a a humility check.
Yeah, it keeps you humble. Now, all right, all I need to do is click on a code here, so I'll click on a code, and now graph issues. Okay, so. All right, I'm in the graph, but yeah, there's, all right, first of all, it's tiny.
There's no alt button on a phone.
There's no alt button on a phone.
So all you have to do is drag those around, I guess.
Yeah, can I even drag them around? Whoops. Maybe.
I can't even do a shift enter when I'm typing text in Google Docs.
Yeah. And I can't. Okay, there we go. I'm making it bigger. I'm still working on this. It's riveting video, isn't it? I actually have a tool that allows me to share my phone screen with viewers online. So if I was desperate to do that, I could. Now I've scrolled this. This is what I got now. I've just scrolled it right off, and all I have is a blank window. So I'm going to call that a fail for now. But if I could figure out a way to make that graph, first of all, just show up full screen on the phone. That should be doable. And then fix that alt button thing. Then you should be able to do it on your phone. And that would be pretty cool. And then fire these things off on Twitter and say, okay, here's today's ethics exercise. Try this out. And maybe collect a few thousand of these.
Because I'm just going to mute while I dictate some replies and text to a colleague.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I like that, dictate some replies. I love artificial intelligence. I really do. I shouldn't say that. I suppose, with all the ethical issues, but I mean, I'm using it half a dozen ways in this course alone just to make it work, and I use it to create the content. I use it for photos to clean up my photographs. I guess that I'm not using that in this course, but I use auto translation. I was at one point just going to go through a list of all the different AI applications that I use, but I never did get to that. But that's another exercise. Maybe I could retroactively add exercises to the course for previous months or previous modules.
Do we even know that we're using an AI sometimes?
A lot of times we don't, I'm sure. I'm certain that when we go into Twitter or Facebook or whatever and look at the feed, that's being created for us by an AI. There may be an AI in our car, but we don't. Certainly in my car there is, because I have adaptive cruise control. And I also have that thing that keeps you between the lines, which it does, but it does it like this. It keeps trying to move to the edge, and it just weaves back and forth. So
that would get you pulled over.
Yeah,
it will. It was my AI.
Yeah. Wasn't my fault. Don't blame me. The person you want to talk to is in Japan.
I guess to your one of your videos is who's to blame? Who's responsible? Who's accountable?
Yeah.
Who's responsible and who's accountable are, I realize, two very different questions.
They are two different questions. Accountability is a tough one. I was sitting in on a IEEE special interest group. It was P1007 or something like that. but basically for ethics in artificial intelligence. And there was a person in that group, maybe 8007, I can't remember. I still have references to it. There was a person in that group who basically was trying to push the line that at a certain point, these artificial intelligences are autonomous, and therefore the responsibility for what they do is separated from the person behind them. Because, you know, the reasoning is you can't be responsible for the actions of something that's acting autonomously. And so there was, you know, for this particular committee, there was a push to, you know, define what they mean by autonomous, define the scope of responsibility around autonomous agents, to basically make the AI responsible. And so
okay, yeah. Now we're getting too close to the singularity for comfort.
I pushed back, as I'm sure you can imagine. I think that certainly for the foreseeable future, responsibility ought to reside in a human and not in the AI or the autonomous agent. Because otherwise that would allow you to, you know, put machine guns on those robot dogs, send them out into the community, they shoot whoever they will, and they are responsible, not you. That seems wrong to me. And I think it seems wrong to most people, although apparently, based on this discussion in this group, not everyone. Once again, we run into this barrier against consensus. Some people think that, no, really, if it's an autonomous agent, you shouldn't be responsible for what an autonomous agent does. But there's plenty of parallels, right? What about your children? Parents are responsible for what their children do. To a point, though, right? And it's not equally applied in all societies. And, you know, I think the point of view of some people, and to a degree I agree with this, is the edict of children will be children, right? Parents can't control children all the time. And children are going to do stupid things. And it's unreasonable to hold the parent accountable when a child does a stupid thing that the parent really had no way of controlling for or preventing. Particularly if the consequences are, really expensive. A child who's just wandering around the neighborhood, as children do, gets into a bulldozer, turns it on, and plows through a house. It's hard to say that the parent ought to pay for the house. It's almost, you would think of that as more like an act of God than an act of parental misresponsibility. It seems to me that way anyways. I'm not sure there would be unanimity on that. I don't know. What do you think?
Stephen froze.
Usually me that freezes. I thought I froze.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, man. Oh, it says my internet connection is unstable. That's annoying. Am I back?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Gee. How could my internet connection be unstable? Well, it's probably downloading something in the background. I got Windows 11 over last weekend, and not everything is comfortable the way it should be. But I'm not uploading anything.
I thank you for leading the way in that and complaining about it, because I'm ignoring that blue button on my...
Yeah. It's not... I mean, it's okay... But I am noticing some things, like the PowerPoint that plays audio on me. that was pretty weird.
Yeah, I noticed that yesterday in yesterday's recording.
Yeah.
I kept thinking it was me. I kept, because I watched the recording afterwards, I kept stopping the recording, looking at my tabs. Oh, it's not me.
Yeah. There's no sign of where the audio is coming from, and you're not expecting it.
It was embedded in the slide.
Yeah, it's got to be.
You copied the slide from another presentation. It came along with it.
Yeah. Just totally unexpected. I should have expected it, but I didn't. The oddest thing with Windows 11 is the keyboard. It doesn't change the keyboard, but I think it's doing, like, when you type on a key in a computer system, what happens is your operating system does basically what's called a keyboard scan. It's keyboard scanning. So it's basically constantly watching for you to press a key, and then it scans what the input from that key was, and then it processes that input. Windows 11 does a lot more processing of that input than Windows 10 did. A lot more. Which I find a bit suspicious, because, you know, key logging and key tracking are the sorts of functions that sometimes happen in the whole key scan process. But what I've noticed, the effect is that it often misses when I capitalize a word. Because, you know, I type fairly quickly and go, right? And, you know, yes, the caps key is down when I press the letter, but if it takes half a second or a few milliseconds to recognize that the caps key or the shift key is down, right, I might press the shift key and press my letter and then move on too quickly for it to realize that I've pressed the shift key when I've pressed the letter key. That seems to be happening. It's very annoying. Okay, that's a little...
I'd like to circle back to the autonomy discussion. Because it occurred to me while you were speaking that, another way to look at it.
Yeah.
Corporate autonomy.
Yeah. So
corporations are human creations, like artificial intelligence.
Yep.
That broke a big red flag while you were talking, because at least in the United States, corporations have rigged the legal system to resolve them almost all responsibility.
Yeah.
Except for their shareholders.
That's true.
And it seems to me that that would be the first thing if I had a corporation that was building armed quadrupeds, I would reach for corporate law to resolve myself of responsibility.
That's a really good point.
And not very comforting.
Yeah. So, and actually, if you think about it, technically, you could create a corporation that actually is your autonomous agent.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
Each agent will become a corporation with all the
Yeah. And really, the only barrier to that is the cost of incorporating.
You just go to Delaware, go buy these states. It's not very expensive. A thought came and went there. It went. But yeah, that's not very comforting. And I find the whole AI thing not very comforting.
But it is so powerful, and like, you know, Stephen has pointed out numerous times, it can consider so much more data than even a large think tank of humans could and correlate it accurately, that there's no way people are going to abandon it just because it might get it wrong, there might be some collateral damage. It's kind of a fact. Stephen, I was going to ask, in that discussion about who's responsible and that humans are not responsible for AI, was there any talk of consequences?
I'm not sure what you mean when you say that.
Okay, so if I do something wrong, if I speed, the consequences are I might get a speeding ticket.
Yeah.
I can't say it was my self-driving car that did it. if AI is going to be, I think I wrote down here, if AI responsibility is separated from the person behind it, then if AI has that responsibility, accountability to the AI, was there any talk of what would the consequences be for an AI that caused harm?
None. There was none. Presumably, yeah, the consequence would be you shut off the AI. So, you know, sort of like the AI death penalty for every offense that exists. But other than that...
Or you just renumber the AI.
You just renumber it, yeah.
Identification number. Reprogram it as a different corporation.
Yeah.
That was a thought that went flicking through that I lost. I've been advocating... I'm in the United States. I'm in California. And I'm in a Quaker town where I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
And since the 70s, I've, of course, been against the death penalty, except in one instance, and that's for corporations. Since corporations are human creation, I have no problem with the death penalty for corporations. They were created by law, and they could be killed by law.
Mm-hmm.
I disagree with killing humans by law. So that's always been my bright line. And that would be... that position would be consistent with corporate AI. So that was pleasing in its consistency, but yet still terrifying in in this application. And I'm just imagining that there are some of those quadrupeds patrolling fence lines somewhere in the world right now. I'm certain. Yeah. I can't prove it, but I'm certain of that. It was at a arms fair, and I'm certain that's so they're patrolling a fence line. And like Jim said, there's no going back. The genie is out of the bottle, I guess, is the analogy. And the thought is that the law is always behind the technology, and as the technology accelerates, the law is further behind. This looks like a real problem. Not more than an ethical problem.
Interestingly, a concept that comes up not only in ethics but also in law is the concept of intent. And that's used to distinguish between an act of malice or malfeasance with an accident. And we can imagine some of these, we'll use robot dogs with guns because it's a good test case. Unlike Sharita's dog, which is unarmed.
We hope.
We can imagine such an autonomous agent accidentally shooting someone. There's a wide variety of ways that could happen. It could be hacked, in which case the responsibility is somewhere else. We don't know where. It could just bump against something and accidentally go off. I mean, that happens to humans all the time. It could be aiming for something, you know, aiming to disarm the opponent, but its aim isn't very good. Or it could have just been deployed carelessly. Without the intent of killing anyone, but, you know, they didn't really take precautions, and it did. How does that affect our considerations?
At the risk of being too talkative, I would reach for... I believe that if you have a corporation that produces weapons...
Mm-hmm.
The weapons are, they have a purpose, and it's to kill. And I don't understand why corporations that produce weapons are not responsible for the proper use of what they produce. I never understood that. That doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah. That's interesting in the sense that such a principle could be applied to weapons manufacturers today, such as gun manufacturers. And yet, I haven't actually heard of a case in which a gun manufacturer has been held accountable for a gun death. I've heard of people suggesting that as a means of addressing the problem of gun deaths, but I haven't heard of a successful action.
Nor have I. It's been attempted, especially these cheap handguns in the U.S. Again, I'm in the U.S., so it's an alternate reality. For sure.
The NRA is a fairly powerful lobby that would stand against that. My mind goes to the Winchester Mansion, where someone did take responsibility, you know, assume some accountability or responsibility. Yeah.
But there's also a code in law, and I know it applies in Canada, and it probably applies in the U.S. as well, under the heading of what they call man traps, such that if you set a man trap, generically a human trap, on your property, and it kills someone, you are legally liable for that death. And that's why you can't set up booby traps in your house. Well, you can't, but you shouldn't. What about some of the other ethical values? Let's see now. Because there's more than just accountability that we need to consider. Let's see, what have we got here? Pursuit of knowledge. Do you think that's an ethical virtue or an ethical value? Kind of a puzzler?
I'm having a hard time connecting it to ethics, unless the knowledge, you know, there could be ethical motivations for the pursuit of knowledge and unethical motivations for the pursuit of knowledge. Interesting.
Well, I mean, think of it in the sense of an ethical code, and the ethical code is describing what is ethical to, say, a research professional, and the thing that is ethical, or what makes it ethical, is that it is in the service of the pursuit of knowledge. And if we think of that, and this comes up on research ethics boards sometimes, where there needs to be a purpose to the research that's being undertaken. You're not just asking questions of people or taking samples or whatever just for fun. You're doing it in the name of the pursuit of knowledge, and that's what makes it good. You think there should be a special case for actions that are undertaken in the pursuit of knowledge?
As opposed to in pursuit of a cure?
Well, or as opposed to curiosity. For example, in the early days of the World Wide Web, there used to be random web page browsers. They were actually on search engines, and you'd click on the button. It would send you to a random home page, and I would just sit there clicking that button over and over again, looking at all of these different home pages. So I'm collecting data, arguably, right? But I'm just doing it for fun. For jollies. Now, suppose there were ethical implications to me looking at that data. Suppose instead of looking at web pages, I'm looking at individuals' personal health data. And I'm hitting that button and looking at one person's health data, then another person's health data. And I'm not trying to find out anything. I'm just looking at it for fun. Do you think that's something different from looking at individual health data for the purposes of research or pursuit of knowledge or discovery of new drugs? Or,
well, when you put together a research proposal, one of the things that is looked at is the reason for doing it? Is the reason for doing it, you know, a benefit to somebody?
Yeah.
Right? So that's, you know, that's one way of, you know, that's what happens in terms of research.
Mm-hmm.
You know, does research get done just for the hell of it? Sure it does. But you don't put that through the ethics
board. You don't tell the ethics board that. Yeah. That's pretty interesting, because I agree. I mean, a lot of research is curiosity driven.
Oh, absolutely. You know,
my advisor in my master's program, Deb Zorms, did her PhD research on how researchers end up doing the research they want to do no matter what they say.
Yeah.
They find a way to do the research that they want to do. So curiosity is a, you know, we talk about in education, curiosity being the great motivator, the thing that gets people engaged.
Mm-hmm.
And so curiosity, pursuit of knowledge, what's the difference? Sorry, Sharita, I think I may have cut you off.
No, it's fine.
That brings up ethics, you know, on a couple of levels. There's the ethics of the curiosity, then there's the ethics of jittering the proposal to accomplish the goal, despite the ethical limitations possibly imposed by the board. I was just looking at an interesting case that I think is on point here this morning. There's a doctor in China, American educated doctor, He Jian Ki, my Chinese is terrible, who's in prison in China because he genetically modified two eggs that were HIV infected and then implanted them with humans. And there are two children in China that were genetically modified before they were born. And he jiggered his proposal to get it through the review board, and actually what he's in prison for is committing fraud, saying that it was approved, and the person whose signature is on the approval didn't sign the document. So that's what he's in prison for. But what he's done is he's released these two humans into the world and violated malfeasance, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting that they thought the fraud was the thing that they should imprison him for.
Well, again, the law, right?
Yeah.
There's no law against releasing genetically modified humans.
Yeah.
No law against it. So they got him on what they could get him on, which was fraud. But he's, you know, in another year, he'll be back out pursuing his curiosity.
Yeah. I think there's the other side of that, too, is because that's, you know, that's the pursuit of research. And the other side of pursuit of knowledge is for the purposes of education, for the purpose of teaching people. And I think that people do draw a line between what is allowed for the purpose of education and, again, what is allowed just because you think it's fun. Copyright infringement is a classic example. It's explicitly stated in U.S. copyright law that using it for educational purposes is one of the purposes that can qualify your use as an instance of fair use. And similar provision in Canada applies to fair dealing. But it's not so clear that this applies to all things. For example, saying something offensive in your class maybe in the past might have been justified for the purposes of education, but has recently resulted in professors or teachers being suspended or fired because it's no longer viewed as acceptable for the purpose of education. And so, it's interesting here. We go back to intent, right? The purpose of your action does seem to play a role in the moral value of your action. And we see that a lot throughout ethics. Although ethical codes, just thinking about this out loud right now, don't seem to clearly draw out that distinction between the purpose or your intent and the result. In fact, at the end of the video on values, and you know, I had just done this hour-long video, and I'm sitting there reflecting on it live while I'm doing this because, you know, and I realized or came to the thought that the ethical codes, the way they describe what is ethical and what is not ethical, are very focused on in terms of outcome and process, as opposed to, say, intent. And it felt at the time, after spending an hour going through all of these things that the ethical codes found valuable, worthy of value, is that it felt very technical and mechanistic. And so that approach was kind of technical and mechanistic, as opposed to perhaps a non-technical or non-mechanistic approach that might take into account intent, might take into account feelings, although it's hard to explain that, how you can take that into account. There's a couple of things, like when we're talking about non-maleficence, what counts as a harmful act isn't just described in the act itself, but in how people react to that act, how people feel about that act. What counts as harmful, you have to, you know, it's not just your opinion as to whether something is harmful. It's also the opinion of whoever you've harmed. And different people feel harmed by different things. And that seems to be more on the human side of it. That's what I felt, anyways. Do you know, we've been doing this ethical codes thing now for 4 weeks. Do you feel any sort of that distinction coming out?
I was surprised, I have to say, this week, that the ethical codes were restricted is not the right word, but that they were professional organizations' ethical codes.
Mm-hmm.
And limited is the word, but I was like, because I take a broader approach, and so what I'm wondering and hoping in the future actually is that we can take your graph and the way you distilled out use cases or applications, whatever you call it. I'm wondering if we can distill out mores and values that obviously underlie these professional codes. Because that's what I found missing in all of them. Yeah, they're very, they're technical, they're linguistic, they're organizational by definition. And what I found missing were values that they're based on. And you could say, well, they're all Western, right? I didn't see Saudi Arabian Nurse Association codes or whatever, you know. So you can say, well, they're based on the Western values, but I think that's probably true.
I do want to make my list of codes more broad. I did try to include international sources as much as I could, but my knowledge of them was obviously limited. But these core values and priorities that I talked about in that video, that's what these codes contain. That's what they say are the values underlying these codes. So if you were to be looking for these underlying values or mores, this is what an analysis of these codes finds. Now I have another video upcoming on the bases for these values and principles, right? So we've got this long list of values, and what sort of reasoning underlies that list of values. And so I look at things like universality, the idea that a principle should be universal, fundamental rights, natural rights, for example, fact, which is an interesting thing. You know, it's a fact that if you blow up an atomic bomb in a city, you will kill most of the people in the city. Simple fact. The question of balancing risks and benefits is something that comes up a lot. Social good or social order comes up, but not nearly as much as you might think. It comes up in the sense that the professions believe that the practice of the profession contributes to the social good and the social order. So it's sort of like a what's good for us is good for society sort of approach. Fairness comes up a lot, and we're going to talk a lot more about fairness. I actually list it as one of the values, but it's also a value underlying a lot of the values. Another factor is epistemology. What we can know, what we can reasonably expect to be the case. You can't be responsible for a bad consequence if you could not have predicted that this would be the bad consequence. It's like the butterfly effect. You can't be held responsible for something that's not reasonably expected. You kill a butterfly and the civilization falls a few years later. You weren't responsible for the fall of that civilization, I think. Trust comes up a lot. Mechanisms for obtaining trust, keeping trust, the need for trust for society to function. And then finally, defensibility. Can you make an argument for this value or that value? So those are the things that underlie these ethical codes. And to the point of studying these codes themselves, in and of themselves, it doesn't get any deeper. And my own considered conclusion, and it only gets reinforced the more I look at these codes, is that there is no set of values or even bases for these values that is common across all of these codes, or for that matter is common across society, much less common across global society. I mean, even inside fairly cohesive societies, we don't see this commonality. And I know a lot of people say, yes, there is this commonality. But if you actually look at things like ethical codes, it's not there. That's why I put in that Feld study. I don't know if I'm pronouncing the name properly. But I really, really wanted people to see that, because this is one of these things that suggests that, oh yes, there is a commonality. And in fact, I'm going to share my screen here. Right screen. There we go. So this is that analysis. Jessica Feld, or maybe Fjeld, I'm not sure, and some others. So you have all of these values around, all of these ethical codes around the outside. And then the key themes, and there you go, human rights, human values, professional responsibility, human control of technology, fairness and non-discrimination, transparency and explainability, safety and security, accountability, privacy. If you look at this chart, it looks like, oh yeah, everybody agrees with these things, right? Now, they've only studied codes of ethics or statements of principle for analytics and artificial intelligence. So that's one thing, and that's kind of what prompted me to look at other disciplines. But we scroll down a bit, and these are the ethical codes that they studied. So a pretty respectable list, and many of these are in our list as well. So, but if we come down here and let's look at one of them, accountability, which is something we've already discussed, the consensus, as expressed by these numbers, doesn't exist. I'll just make that. Can I make that bigger? Sure, I can. So look at this, right? So for accountability, verifiability and replicability, is that part of accountability? 36% say yes. Impact assessments, is that part of accountability? 53%. Environmental responsibility, only 17%. Ability to appeal, which we hear about a lot, 22%. Remedy for automated decision, covered in only 11% of these ethical codes. Liability and legal responsibility, which we talked about, 31%. And even just accountability as accountability, only 69% of these codes. So there is no consensus. Even in the places where they say there's consensus, there really is no consensus. And those sorts of results, I mean, they go through all of those areas, all of those values or areas of interest, and those charts are the same for each one. You never find a consensus. Looks like consensus if you talk about it, you know, you just use a word like freedom, responsibility, accountability. Yeah, everybody loves accountability, but when you drill down to what it means, there's no consensus. And that's why I've structured the course the way I did. All right, we look at all the applications for AI and analytics and learning. Look at all the issues that have been raised from different sources. Now we're looking at all these ethical codes, and it seems like just painstakingly and mind-bendingly dull to go, you know, this thing, then this thing, then this thing. But if you study it at that level, the conclusions that people have drawn looking at, you know, a more general level just turn out to be false. I think that's a really important thing to say, personally. And it raises a hard question. What do we say about ethics when there's no consensus on ethics? Mm-hmm. How do we solve the problem of unethical AI? Unethical practices in learning and learning analytics. So that's part of what I'm trying. That is pretty much what I'm trying to address in this course. That question. So, but I figured it's useful to know what all these issues are and what all these values are, anyways, right? I mean, I think it is for us. Certainly having this list is useful. I think it's useful enough that I'm setting up the course in such a way that it will produce JSON formatted data dumps of all of these things that other people can use in other applications or other courses. So if you want a list of all of the values that come up in ethical codes or ethical discussions generally, access this JSON document, just feed it right into your application. Open data. But I think the questions raised are significant. Thoughts with that?
I don't know that there's any, that there can be any one answer to that question. It's something, I think the process of looking at all these things is the value.
Mm-hmm.
Coming up with an absolute answer, I don't think you can do that.
Yeah. I think I agree. To both parts of that. Yeah.
Yeah. It isn't a yes no. It isn't a either or. It's something. Okay, you mentioned a little bit of this way at the beginning, and you mentioned a mesh.
Mm-hmm.
So the discussion is the mesh.
Right.
Right. And then I don't know if you figure it out individually or you figure it out contextually, but you come up with some kind of quasi answer for what you're doing at the moment with what you're using, which I guess, you know, I guess that's human.
Now, I'm inclined to agree with that. Fleshing that out is the hard thing.
Yeah.
But this is the end of our time. Thanks, Jim, and goodbye. This is the end of our time, but Mark?
Okay, so as a sociologist, then you've convinced me that there's no way to control behavior, that unethical behavior is inevitable. Then, as a sociologist, I just want to talk about mitigating.
Mm-hmm.
How do we mitigate?
Mm-hmm. How do you mitigate the harm?
Yes, AI is in the world as all those genetically altered humans.
Yep.
And so now I want to mitigate. You convinced me that I am going from my life and everybody else's, from this point forward, yeah. I'm convinced that they will be, and I perceive it as attack, so
yeah.
I won't use that word, but they will have to deal with completely unethical and dangerous behavior forever. And so then the discussion for me, I want to move to how do we make it how do we protect the common
good?
That's how I would say, or it's not used.
Do you regulate it?
I think you've convinced me that's impossible. At this moment, I'll change my mind later. But I'm saying at this moment, I'm convinced between application of chaos theory, the review of these ethical codes, what I know about human behavior. Let's say at this moment, I'm convinced that extremely unethical things will take place forever. And so then the discussion has, yes, can you regulate it? No, apparently not. And so...
Yeah, because some people don't even think of it as unethical.
On the unethical actors. I don't think that's the
scene. No.
Yeah. So this is the pivotal turn of the course, I think. Right? I think we've made the argument, and now the question becomes... What do we do about that?
Yeah.
Right. And starting with next week, the process is a bit different, where now we're going to work our way carefully, painstakingly, step by step, because that's the level of analysis in this course, toward a solution. Toward something we can say that is reasonable and addresses these issues in a way that is satisfactory, at least to us. I think that's possible. I know that the problem has been set out so that it's pretty much intractable. We can't agree what on ethics is. There's no way to define even the underlying values. Meanwhile, this technology is taking off, and there are robot dogs with guns out there already, and it's only going to get worse. What do we do? So, we'll leave it on that note. You had one more thing to say, Mark?
A famous book that poses the question, at least in translation, what then must be done?
What then must be done?
Familiar.
Yeah, very good.
I think that's where we are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, next week, we begin to find the answers. Okay.
Okay.
We're going to call it there. Hope we've left our viewers in suspense.
Cliffhanger. Yeah.
All right. Bye, everyone.
Bye.